My name is Rob Farley. I am an assistant professor at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. With me today is Justin Logan. How are you doing today, Justin?
I'm fine, Rob. So apologies again for having screwed up this previous dialogue that we did, but I'm pleased that you were patient enough to have me back.
Well, there are many cases in which the dialogues that people watch are actually the second iteration, and I'd be curious about how many people can actually detect whether they're watching the original dialog or a second re-up of it. But it certainly happens quite a bit that we lose one. Could you introduce yourself? Most of the people out there know you.
Well, I wouldn't go be so bold as to say that. Anyway, I'm Justin Logan. I'm the Director of Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute here in Washington.
Okay. So the discussion of the day and what we're going to talk about today is we're starting small, but we're starting from one point and we're working toward larger points. And the point we're starting at is a recent paper that you authored at Cato regarding U.S. policy towards China and sort of more broadly U.S. policy towards the rise of China. And so why don't we start off by you discussing what your main argument is with regards to how the United States should react to the rise of China.
Sure. So the paper has a couple of central points. The first point that I make is that there's a general consensus around American China policy in Washington, and the consensus holds that the United States should both engage China and contain China. So by way of background, Zalmay Khalilzad wrote a paper with a team of people at the RAND Corporation in the late 1990s that argued that the United States should engage China, which is not a particularly euphemous term that we foreign policy types like to come up with, but the basic argument was that the United States should engage China economically and contain it militarily. And I argue in the paper that is, but for all intents and purposes, America's China policy. We are very deeply engaged with China economically, and we're also attempting to ring it with an array of more or less anti-China alliances, bilateral alliances for the most part. And so I argue in the paper that this is internally contradictory, right? Because the more deeply engaged you become, the more difficult it becomes to contain China militarily because of relative gains from trade. Actually, poorer countries gaining relatively more than wealthier countries. China is beginning to narrow the relative power gap between the United States and China. So the first main argument of the paper is that America's China policy is sort of incoherent, right? That the two main prongs of it are working at cross purposes. And then the second argument that I make is that the United States has had a policy for decades, really, of infantilizing its allies and seeking to make them security clients who are reliant on the United States for protection. And I argue that that free ride should end and that the United States should push those countries to do more to exert themselves in security issues in the region. So at the risk of boring everyone too badly, I think I'll leave it at those two major points.
Right. And the second point often comes up in context of our complaints about our NATO allies or about Japan or about anyone else, not shouldering enough of the burden. And it's also kind of it's fascinating to me that this happens almost simultaneously and almost often in the same sentence as, but our allies will quickly develop doubts about our resolve if we drop our defense budget an iota, right? So we are simultaneously haranguing them to develop their military capabilities to a greater extent, and we are simultaneously haranguing ourselves with regards to having too small of a defense budget, which, you know, to me has always been. Have always been directly contradictory arguments, right? That just don't make any sense.
Yeah, no, I agree entirely.
Right. Now, what you have done here is to engage in a broader argument about how the United States reacts to potential challengers from Eurasia, from anywhere else really. And you're becoming part of, and I mean you've been part of this before, but you're certainly intervening in this conversation that you know, Stephen Walt is having, that Posen is having, that Barry Posen, that very recently an article came out in Foreign Affairs and a similar article in International Security by Eikenberry, Woolforth, and Stephen Brooks. And I think Brooks was the first on there, so we should probably call it Brooks et al. About the distinction between offshore balancing and, or that involves a debate between strategies of offshore balancing and deep engagement. And it seems very clear to me that where you fall is on the offshore balancing pole of this that's associated with people like Chris Lane and other people, right? A whole bunch of realists who argue that the United States needs to retrench. Now, you're pretty comfortable with that claim, right? I mean, you're pretty comfortable with the retrenchment phrase, right?
Yeah, I don't object to retrenchment at all. The one caveat that I would put in is that I think the United States should retrench, but whereas people like Chris Lane think that the United States is sort of currently being forced to retrench because of balancing on the part of other powers and because of fiscal woes at home. I don't think so. My is and my ought are not aligned here. I think we should retrench, but I think that we're unlikely to do so for the foreseeable future. So one small tweak on the general story.
Right. So in part of this conversation and part of the argument that Brooks and Eikenberry and so forth. And I mean, I think that they make what is on its own terms a coherent enough case for deep engagement. So we can treat it as a case worth reacting to. Part of their argument with regards to deep engagement, which is you know a very forward policy of the United States, that they suggest has been happening since basically the end of World War II and should continue happening. To their credit, they do not engage in this contradictory, you know, we need to spend more and our allies need to spend more. They come back and they say it's actually a good thing that countries like Japan, that other India, that other countries around the Indo-Pac region, which I think that term is coming into usage, which is probably a good thing, I'm not sure. It's a good thing that Japan and China are not engaging in an arms race. It's good for the United States. It's good for Japan and India. It's even good for China. And so, you know, this thing that you know, we complain about our allies periodically not shouldering enough of the burden, but actually it's fabulous. It's fabulous that they don't shoulder very much of the burden because it allows us to be the primary provider of order, which works out well for the United States, which incidentally works out well for the rest of the world. Now, why are you skeptical about that story?
Right. So I think you've characterized it exactly right. What I see is a bug of the strategy, they see as a feature. Right. So they say, look, if the United States, and let's sort of by a 15-second rewind. So they make an argument about Europe, they make an argument about the Middle East, and they make the argument about Asia. My sort of Thanatos-induced scholarship interests have led me to take what I think is the hardest case for my position, which is Asia. It's very, very difficult to make the case that the world will go to hell if the United States gets out of Europe. And I think there's a growing consensus that getting out of the Middle East might be a smart thing to do. So Asia is sort of really grasping the nettle, if you will. But I think you're quite right that they say, look, if the United States does what Logan says in Asia, what will happen is this sort of traditional spiral scenario where you get arms races between competing powers and the world starts looking a lot like it did surrounding the time of World War I. And I just don't think that that spiral story captures a lot of what's likely to happen in Asia. The first and biggest difference, I would say, is that the geography of Europe looks a lot different than the geography of the Asia-Pacific or the Indo-Pacific or whatever we care to call it. Water is a sort of offshore balancer's friend. And so I look at what's going on, for example, surrounding the Senkaku Daoyu Islands or even into the South China Sea. and say, look, this is a problem, right? They're disputing these territories, but it just doesn't look to me like a replay of World War One. And I think the scholarship surrounding World War One actually calls into question the extent to which the analogy holds in Asia, to say nothing of the presence of nuclear weapons and a number of other things that people think would inhibit this sort of nightmare scenario that Brooks et al. Allude to. So I sort of don't think that that story, the sort of spiral story, tells an accurate sort of future counterfactual about what's likely to happen if America retrenches.
So if we can, and I don't want to really want to rewind, but I want to get to sort of a foundational U.S. interest in East Asia. If I were to argue that the foundational U.S. interests in East Asia are primarily as follows, it is the deep and tight integration of the U.S. economy with the economies of the Pacific Rim, so with China, with Japan, with various Southeast Asian economies, you know, Malaysia and so forth, Singapore, to a lesser extent with India, right? I mean, there is less trade exposure to India, and that this is fundamentally why the United States is interested in this region, because our economic prosperity is tied up with the prosperity of these countries and with peaceful, robust economic transactions between and outside of this region. And the argument then would be that even to the extent that we're not really worried about a replay of World War One, right? The Japanese aren't going to invade Manchuria. You're not going to see, you know, a Battle of Tannenberg, a Battle of the Marne or something like that between India and China or Japan and China. That the devotion of ever greater amounts of the national treasure of Japan and China and India to defense and the prospect of really any sort of instability and any sort of conflict between the three puts American prosperity at some risk. And so therefore it's worth this small percentage of our GDP to put a thumb on the scale and to prevent that kind of development from happening, right? I mean, even to the extent where we have India threatening China's energy resources, which it certainly can do, or China threatening Japan's energy resources, which it certainly can do, that it's worthwhile for the United States to prevent that from happening, and it's worthwhile to devote at least a little bit of American treasure and the promise of some American blood to maintain our finance capital in East Asia or something along those lines, if we were to put it in vulgar Marxist terms. I guess, why do you think that that story is not quite right?
Sure. Well, there are a couple points to make. First of all, it's true that as a percentage of U.S. GDP, the price that we pay to dampen other countries defending themselves in Asia is small. But even a small percentage of our GDP is an awful lot of money that both liberals and conservatives and even libertarians could, I think, figure out lots of fruitful uses for. So it also bears mentioning that as time goes on, that cost is going to go up. But I don't think I sort of have a fundamentally different view of how globalization and economics is playing here that is totally at odds with the conventional wisdom in Washington, and that relates a lot to an article that Eugene Goltz and Daryl Press wrote about the effects of wars on neutral countries. And so the conventional wisdom says, look, the international economy has become increasingly connected. Everyone's economic well-being is connected to everyone else's economic well-being. Therefore, wars between third parties can have hugely deleterious consequences, even for countries that are not parties to the war itself. And they essentially argue exactly to the contrary, that the profound economic interdependence has produced redundancies in the global economy rather than dependencies, right? So if the supply chain is interrupted in one place or the other, there's a considerable ability to backfill with other suppliers, right? We remember the tsunami in Japan, and there was this great amount of discussion about the extent to which a number of things were going to go away for some time in American consumer markets, and that simply didn't happen. Well, I haven't dug.
Well, I mean, there was some. I mean, I have to say that living in Kentucky, there was some pain. I mean, we Lexington is right next to one of the largest Toyota factories in the world. I think it's the largest Toyota factory in the country, and workers were not laid off, but were given extra training and a variety. I mean, Toyota managed, but it certainly slowed down Toyota operations in Kentucky for quite a while when the tsunami struck.
Sure. No, I didn't mean to say that there were no consequences, but when you juxtapose a slowdown at a Toyota plant in Kentucky with the costs of prospectively a great power shooting war in Asia, mm-hmm. I would argue that on aggregate, those economic costs tend to be outweighed even by exclusively the economic costs potentially of a shooting war in Asia.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I find that argument appealing, and one of the reasons I find that argument appealing is because one of the things I study is strategic bombing, and almost without fail, people who think that strategic bombing is a good idea, whether sort of your World War I Giulio de Hett types, or your World War II Hap Arnold types, or your much later John Warden types, almost invariably overestimate the effect that war will have on an economy, right? Which is another way of underestimating the complexity of an economy. And so suggesting that a war or even tension between Japan and China would be really disruptive of the world economy does sound wrong to me in the way that Gold suggests, that Eugene suggests that it might be wrong, right? Because the world economy does have these redundancies built in, does have more complexity than is generally allowed. At the same time, and I'll admit that I haven't read the article, it really does seem, I mean, we are talking about when we talk about the effects of war and the effects of tension on neutral parties, what we're talking about in this particular case is three of the world's four largest economies potentially getting into conflict, right? I mean, India isn't there yet, but it will be soon. And it seems to me that there are very few cases that are quite exactly like that. And I can see the reluctance of policymakers in Washington to be willing to test the assertion that the U.S. economy will be just fine in context of shooting or even very serious tense but non-shooting relations between Japan and China, or China and India, or Japan and India and China. I mean, that seems pretty risk acceptant to sort of sit back and say, things will probably be fine even if there's a war, so let's not do anything.
Well, I think that policymakers,
I can appreciate why they're not that risk acceptant.
I think folks here in town tend to accept a lot more risk than I'm willing to accept in issues where there's sort of, what's the word I'm looking for, momentum, inertia behind a policy, right? So we have this murky commitment to go to war with China over Taiwan. Now, I'm going to say that's risky, right? We've had a dampening of political radicalism, I guess, in Taiwan over the last decade or so. But is that risky or not risky? To me, that looks risky. So I agree with you that that's accepting a certain amount of risk to listen to my story about how the global economy works. But there's a sort of different story baked into American policy at present that I think is wrong, that people can adjudicate or disagree with one way or the other. But it's true that I'm asking policymakers to take on different risks, but I'm also taking pretty big existing risks off the ledger.
Right. So, when I read your piece, there was one, and I don't remember exactly which page, but there was one passage that where you expressed what I felt was undue disdain for the other element of a deep engagement strategy that we haven't quite talked about yet, which is the construction development maintenance, promulgation of international institutions, which surely is part of the story of any kind of deep engagement strategy. And that's why we have the Eikenberry in the Eikenberry, Brooks, and Woolforth piece about why the United States needs to be deeply engaged, right? It's not just about military power. It's also about the the development of robust international institutions that can shape Chinese behavior, that can shape the behavior of other countries by norming, by socialization, and so forth. So my sense, it's not really my sense. I mean, I think that you don't think that these international institutions do very much, and they're not really worth devoting a lot of resources to. I mean, is that an accurate statement of your approach to international institutions? Are you a realist, sir? Are you now a realist, or have you ever been a realist?
Have I ever been? Yeah, if you look at my CV, I'm going to come up guilty before I can open my mouth. I'm not sort of a card-carrying new sovereigntist. These things don't worry me very much because I don't think that they constrain the United States in important high politics sorts of ways, right? So I basically do concur with the realist story that international institutions tend to reflect the interests of the powerful states who create them. So I look at the United States behavior over the last 60 years and ask, I don't do this in the paper, but I'm talking about the way my brain works when I think about these things. And I say, where are the instances where international institutions posed powerful constraints on things the United States really wanted to do and at least couched in security interests? And I don't come up with terribly much. And I look at forum shopping in the 1990s where the United Nations says, no, you can't do Kosovo because the Russians and to a lesser extent the Chinese think it's a dumb idea or don't want to do it for a number of reasons. We say, all right, we'll get NATO to sign on. So I do sort of buy the hardline realist story about international institutions that they just don't have a lot of sort of constraint. And, you know, you might add, this is an analogy that I've been thinking about lately that may or may not work, but I sort of don't think that the law constrains the American government in a general sense, right? I basically think that everything is politics, that people construe norms, international institutions, and in a domestic context, the law, in ways that suit political desires. So I don't know whether that's – I may be sort of spitballing here and getting off topic, but I do think that – politics is by far a more powerful force than legal constraints. And so we can talk about norms in international politics, too. But, yeah, I don't grant a whole lot of explanatory power to international institutions or, by extension, the sort of John Eikenberry view of the world.
Right. I mean, I'm not sure how productive. I mean, I think we can go down this a little while. I mean, reading these articles, reading your article, reading the Eikenberry Wolf or the Brooks et al. Piece, reading Stephen Walt's commentary on this, with the exception of Eikenberry, what we're talking about mostly here are realists like yourself. And I'm not even saying I'm not a realist, right? I have a realist infection. I don't know exactly how to describe it, but you know, it seems to me that the way that you're approaching international institutions is wrong. I mean, I think that, and not just you, but also some of the other players in this debate, which is really becoming this debate between realists. And I think that the people who, like Brooks and Woolforth and so forth, the deep engagement people, would be much better on much firmer ground to the extent that they talked about international institutions, international norms, international law, and this makes sense to you and me, it may not make sense to people not steeped in IR theory, thinking about hegemony in a Gilpin-esque way, which is a rich hegemony that produces, as you suggest, a whole set of norms, laws, institutions, and so forth that act to the benefit of the major power, being the United States, but that A, sometimes constrain smaller powers that shape the behavior of smaller powers, and that to some extent, and I think to sort of meaningful policy relevant extent, shape the behavior even of the United States. And I know that we talked a little bit about this in the first iteration of this, but it's very hard for me to read an account of really either the first Gulf War or the Kosovo War in the 1990s and say that international institutions are at the phenomenal here, right? That international law and international norms are superfluous, especially given that the major players, even down to an operational level, but even at a strategic level, political level, all the way down, were seemingly obsessed by international institutions, international law, international norms. And I'd go a step further and say that even the neocon turn in the first Bush administration is in part about an active, explicit, and very political rejection of what they saw as very real trends in terms of the United States adhering too closely to international law, adhering to or being too tightly bound by institutional constraints, by the international institutions that it had generated, right? That there's simply a great deal of concern that, in fact, these institutions are doing too much and that we ought to take strong policy measures to push back on those. That's how I approach this question. I mean, it seems to me like you need to tell a better story about why international institutions aren't mattering in this case and why they're not going to help shape Beijing's behavior.
Well, I have two responses to that. The first is, if international institutions powerfully constrain the most profound interests of states, then why talk about China at all, right? Why worry about security competition in Asia at all if you have, you know, a great amount of faith?
You're strawmanning. You're strawmanning here, right? I mean, nobody thinks that just because you have United Nations or a League of Nations that you aren't going to have conflict. Of course you're going to have conflict. Of course you're going to have different interpretations of the UNCLOS, the law of the sea, and so forth. And of course states are going to make politically motivated arguments in terms of interpretation of international law and international norms. But there is a very large middle ground between saying that simply because you have a UN Security Council, you're not going to have any major conflict in the world, and saying that the UN Security Council is irrelevant, right, or that international law and international norms are irrelevant.
Mm-hmm. So what? Well, then the other thing that I was going to say is, why don't you tell me the story about the first Gulf War and about Kosovo that shows the sorts of constraints that the United Nations and other international institutions pose on the prerogatives of great powers, and how that sort of applies to shaping China's desires and pursuits in the 21st century, right? So what do those cases tell you about how to use international institutions to constrain what great powers want to do?
I think in terms of the Kosovo War, that the United States was, the reason that the United States was particularly interested in what was happening in Kosovo was because of institutional constraints, right? Because of the belief that the NATO alliance was a value that the United States ought to have, that supporting institutionalization of international relations in Europe was a strong positive goal, and that you had a leadership in the United States that was socialized to this belief, appropriately or inappropriately, and they did hold this as a value. When the war was actually conducted in operational terms, the timing of the war was determined through alliance negotiation, often with players who weren't meaningful in any kind of military terms, but that had political clout. The conduct of the war, from target selection to escalation, was measured through, again, alliance politics. And also through an eye towards larger outside norms of how great powers should conduct expeditionary wars, should conduct airstrikes, should measure their policies. And the end of the war was also structured in terms, or it was also guided by an understanding of institutional behavior and understanding of institutional norms, right? That the UN would eventually play some role, that the UN would facilitate Russia playing a role and would be a way of working Russia into the final Kosovo settlement in a manner that did not prove tremendously embarrassing to all of the parties. And so I would say, in terms of Kosovo, that it is drenched with institutionalism, that if we lived in a realist world where institutions were irrelevant, we would never have gone to war in Kosovo. Given that we did conduct a war, that we did go to war in Kosovo, that everything we did there was characterized by adherence to some level of international norm, often to the frustration of particular actors.
Sure.
That's my Kosovo story.
Yeah, at the level of sort of state preferences and whether or not realism can get you to a Kosovo war at all, I mm-hmm. basically agree, right? So my view is that mm-hmm. in a unipolar world, realism just doesn't have a whole hell of a lot of explanatory power, right? Realism is about how the structure of the international system poses constraints on state behavior and ultimately pushes the system toward balance. And I think Brooks and Woolforth in World Out of Balance are on really sound ground there, which is that applying a theory about constraints posed on states by the structure of the international system in a system structure that's outside the scope conditions of the theory altogether, unipolarity, isn't going to tell you a whole hell of a lot about how states behave. So I agree, even with your sort of positive analysis of what Kosovo was about. And to put it somewhat less charitably than you did, but I think to make the same point, Kosovo was about stepping on the heads of our European allies to prevent them from forming an autonomous foreign and security policy. If you look at the history of what, even without American intervention, were pretty feckless steps to form a common foreign and security policy throughout the 1990s, this was looked at completely with antipathy by the entire foreign policy establishment in Washington. I think everyone from John Bolton to Madeleine Albright thought that this was a terrible idea. And we had the whole Albright business about the 3Ds. It couldn't, I forget the exact words, but couldn't duplicate, mm-hmm. couldn't decouple, and couldn't, I forget what the other one was, from NATO, right? So we viewed NATO as a way to sort of keep that pacifier in there. And so the Kosovo War, the great fear was that if we didn't do something, the Europeans might get their act together and do something themselves, which would be a dagger pointed at the heart of our institution, NATO. So I do think in that case, the sort of institutional story is epiphenomenal. What we didn't want was the emergence of a serious military power in Europe. I think that's a boneheaded idea. I would like to see the Europeans get their act together, and I think, in fact, the United States has moved slightly in that direction. So I basically agree with the story that you're telling. And I don't try to make this a huge focus of the paper, but I just say when it comes down to important things that I think you can make the case reasonably soundly that, you know, Kosovo, we had a number of reasons for doing it, but it wasn't for what we construed as being, you know, potent security interests in that moment. When it comes to things that states care about passionately, like their own security, it's sort of foolish to place a lot of hope in international institutions. And since the story that I'm talking about in the case of China is, I think, by all lights, issues that China cares about deeply, more deeply than the United States cared about the outcome of the Balkan Wars, I don't tell a whole big story about institutions because I think this is this sort of high politics of high politics. And you know, maybe that straw manning, I don't know, but I didn't see a way to work in institutions in a way that would sort of change the story that I had to tell. It would say, look, if we develop the Trans-Pacific Partnership or if we bring China into the Trans-Pacific Partnership or what have you, that's going to change the outcome of China trying to secure, you know, its littorals or trying to get out, you know, a bit into securing its locks. I just didn't see a way to work that in. So if that's strawmanning, right. I'll plead guilty.
No, well, I don't think that that's strawmanning. But let me phrase it differently. And so, I'm not necessarily asking for a checkbox here, but and in a minute we can, I think we can talk about sort of, can you have the institutional story that I like and have the force posture that you like? Because I think actually you can, right? That which is also sort of a fundamental rejection of the deep engagement strategy. But if we can accept, and I'm happy to accept, that China should not and will not rely solely on the good graces of international institutionalization to secure its absolutely critical national goals, which are territorial integrity, economic prosperity, its access to energy in the Persian Gulf and elsewhere. What about the means through which Beijing understands how it can achieve those goals, right? So what about international institutions that, you know, facilitate a dialogue between Japan and China and India and the United States such that asymmetries of information are reduced, potentially reduced? What about international norms which tell the Chinese, and which they can contribute to, what precisely the littoral is? And this is actually a big thing right now, right? Because what is the South China Sea? And we disagree with the Chinese about this in a sort of a legally oriented way, and they disagree with the Japanese and so forth. But is there a role for institutionalization there? To what extent do institutions like ASEAN give the Chinese some degree of information about how other states feel about what they're doing, and so therefore play some role in the Chinese calculation of what they should do? Sort of the broader question that I'm asking here is, and I think that I suspect that you'll more or less agree with this, that during the 1990s, American policymakers were, for better or worse, convinced by the institutional story, convinced by a form of the institutional story. They were convinced that institutions were important, that they were important to U.S. power. And I would say, actually, even in the Bush administration, once again, policymakers were utterly convinced that institutions are important, but in a bad way, right, that they wanted to get rid of the institutions and the institutional constraints, but they believed in those constraints. To what extent can policymakers in Beijing be convinced that constraints exist and that these constraints in some cases can be good for Chinese power, or at least that abiding by some of those constraints can lead to a world in which China is better able to pursue its interests, pursue its security interests?
Yeah, so two points. First, I certainly don't oppose the sorts of efforts that you're talking about, and it may be the case that some of these institutional contexts could have some marginal salutary, as you say, information asymmetry, imperfect information correcting effect. But just based on sort of my anecdotal evidence and reading the newspaper and hearing Chinese policymakers speak, they sound a whole hell of a lot more like John Mearsheimer to me than they do John Eikenberry. So if they're revealing their preferences by talking to me, which they may not be, and which may be bravado and braggadocio, whatever, then they don't appear to think that having to pay homage to these sorts of international institutions is either A, important to them, or B, a means for them to achieve their objectives. So that may be an argument for trying to make the case that, look, these institutions do constrain the United States in important ways, and if you want to be a big dog on the block like the United States is, you need to pay attention to these institutions too. But the rejoinder that I get when I make this argument to Chinese policy analyst types is, that they believe basically my story about international institutions, that international institutions are created by powerful states to protect their own interests, that they'll be used against China to prevent it from sort of getting its moment in the sun. And the United States, if it were situated as China is situated, would not pay much attention to these institutions if they didn't meet its needs. So that's both unnerving for me. I mean, it would make a better world if the Chinese believe the sort of institutional story. But to my, again, anecdotal experience, and maybe there's a selection effect with the people who in China who are willing to talk to me, they don't like that story. And it's not uniform, et cetera, but they talk and maybe walk a lot like a rising power. And so, sure, I support trying to get trilaterals together between China, Japan, and even the United States, if we were to be able to sit down as a more neutral interlocutor. The way that the Chinese tend to view these things now is two on one, not without reason. But sure, I'm a fan of talking, you know, the Churchill jaw, war quote. I just wouldn't hang a whole lot of hope that those chats are going to cause China to modulate its behavior significantly. So I don't want to sound like the sort of, you know, tinfoil hat type person who thinks that the United Nations is here to sort of drape burkas over our daughters and, you know, create a sort of global government. But at the same time,
Take away our guns. You have to add take away our guns there, too.
Yeah, and take away, yeah. In order to get the burkas over the daughters, they have to get the guns first. Which leads, of course, to jokes about blue helmeted people fighting counterinsurgency wars in Appalachia, which could be a really fun Red Dawn 2 movie. But in any event, yeah, I don't have the sort of passionate antipathy toward international institutions that some people, I think, are overrepresented in Washington and not that well represented in the academy. But I just don't, I don't hang a lot of hope that that's going to change China. But if somebody wants to lead in, an initiative to try to convince the Chinese of that, I wouldn't oppose it as long as they don't necessarily think it's going to work.
Right. I mean, and I guess, I mean, there are some international institutions that it seems to me the Chinese do take quite seriously, right? I mean, it seems to me they take the WTO pretty seriously. To an extent, on many issues, they take the UN fairly seriously. I mean, in the sense that they are a significant participant in UN discussions, and that they use their veto in... I'm not sure responsible is the exact, but in a coherent way, right? I mean, in an understandable way, their veto their veto process is not random or poorly thought out, right?
No, not at all.
They think about it and they use it in a coherent, predictable manner. I also wouldn't say with regards to Chinese adherence to sort of the larger non-proliferation regime, they have not. That adherence has not been ideal. It also has not been completely Wild West either. They have adhered to some of the norms and legal restrictions regarding proliferation of ballistic missiles, proliferation of nuclear weapons in a way that doesn't necessarily seem to me sort of really falls out as completely explainable through realists or through a realist understanding, but it's certainly a mixed bag, and I certainly take seriously the idea. Well, you know, it would be great if they believed international institutions as just as much as Madeleine Albright did, but they don't, and so what are we going to do about that? Go ahead.
No, I was just going to. Yeah, I will. Agree with the last proviso. I don't know if you wanted to do another sort of salvo on Brooks at all, or where to head.
Well, if you feel like launching the guns towards Brooks, that's fine with me.
Sure.
But if you want to, I mean, I do. We do have at least. I want to talk a little bit about what sort of the more military aspects of retrenchment might look like. But
well, let's do that.
If you want to
let's do that.
Okay. Well, to bring it back to Brooks. One of the claims one of the upsides of retrenchment that people argue for is what you've hinted already, is that everyone, libertarians, liberals, conservatives, could use the money we spend on defense in a better way, right? You could use it to shore up the welfare state, you could use it to cut taxes, you could use it to pay down the national debt, whatever, right? I mean, money is money and you can use it, and using it to build more tanks or, you know, more long-range bombers is not necessarily the ideal way to use the American taxpayers' money. And so an upside of retrenchment is being able to cut back. Now, in what I thought was one of the weakest parts of their article, Brooks et al. Talked, you know, they demanded specifics about how retrenchment would play out in a military sense for the United States, right? Where are we getting these savings? Tell me where we're getting these savings. And they had some line about the critics never tell us where these savings are, which I don't think is actually accurate because I think critics have identified a bunch of places. But I guess for you, in terms of looking at the modern Pentagon, the modern DOD, where do you see the upside of retrenchment, the military upside of retrenchment in terms of having fewer people and spending less money? I mean, where would you apply the scalpel or the pickaxe?
Yeah, well, it's a right that I will try not to get too far down into the weeds here. But the basic story mm-hmm. is that how much you spend has an awful lot to do with how much you want to do in the world, right? There's this obsession in Washington with doing more with less or doing the same amount with less. And, you know, that gets couched in all sorts of ways. But if you want to try to run the world in important ways with the American military, it's going to cost you. And so what we argue at Cato, and I think the, you know, the sensible retrenchment types argue, is that the real savings in the military budget don't come from waste, fraud, and abuse or inefficiencies or what have you. Massive millions-person bureaucracies are not efficient entities, if 20th century political science taught us anything. So basically, what if you want to cut the budget, you need to cut end strength and you need to cut these sorts of presence missions. So people like Bob Gates will do this dance where they say, look, you know, we're looking really, really hard for places to cut. And, you know, we looked at Europe, but look, it's going to cost an awful lot of money to build garrisons for those troops if we were to bring them home. And, oh, by the way, they're useful staging places for mucking around in the police, so therefore the savings are really trivial. But that's not what retrenchment people are talking about. They're not talking about bringing 50,000 U.S. troops home. They're talking about getting rid of that military function and thereby getting rid of that end strength. So that's where you really want to have to, that's where you really have to go if you want to make serious cuts to the military budget, is end strength in Asia, to bring it back to the topic earlier. If you really like the presence mission, if you want to get right up in China's face, you can't save a lot of money in Asia. You can't really save any money if you like that. So I think the easiest places to cut, if somebody says, look, I'm not totally on board with this Cato thing. Those guys are a little wacky, but I'd like to get an oar in that lake and start rowing and see where things go from there. The lowest hanging fruit is Europe, right? Russia has a GDP roughly analogous to that of Italy and Portugal combined, or at least that was true a couple of years ago. I don't know how badly the Italian and Portuguese economies have done, pretty badly. But let's say it's Italy, Portugal, and a country to be named later. This is not the Soviet Union of the early 1950s that Europe is looking at. And unless, so the question becomes, what sorts of security threats face Europe? And so Brooks and Woolforth have this argument in their paper about keeping NATO, that talks about how, you know, the alliances in Europe are really useful, not just for military purposes, but they give us institutions like the Atlantic Council, which help us to talk to the Europeans. And that is not a straw man characterization of the argument. That's pretty much verbatim from their article. So to me, people are really reaching when they say we need to keep the commitment to Europe, unless you're willing to go the full John Mearsheimer story and say Germany gets nuclear weapons, it looks an awful lot like the 1930s again, and stuff gets really hairy over there. I don't think many people buy that story. So if you want to cut, you start in Europe. I think there's a clear case for offshoring America's troops in the Middle East. At the very least, getting troops out of Saudi Arabia. Look, if what you want to do is to prevent a regional hegemon from controlling a big chunk of Middle Eastern oil, the American military is terrific at reversing cross-border aggression, right? We've seen that time and time again, and we don't need troops forward deployed to do that. If you want to do all of these fine-tuning the dials on the balance, you can make an argument that you need to have a presence on shore. But to my mind, we could very fruitfully disengage from the Middle East while saying we're not going to allow Iran to annex Saudi Arabia or something like that, that really would be bad,
right,
but is reasonably easy to prevent. You could save a lot of money screwing around in the Middle East less. And I argue in the paper that you know, the sort of we stand down, they stand up argument in Asia would allow you to back off the presence mission there to a significant degree. And that would save you big money as well. You know, the article that Ben and I wrote, which was derivative of an article that he and Chris Preble wrote, would take us down to 8 carrier battle groups. So they, Brooks and Woolforth and Eikenberry, characterized that as having limited reach outside the Western Hemisphere. 8 carrier battle groups give you, you know, considerable reach outside the Western Hemisphere. So those are the sort of 3-step, again, the hardest cases in Asia, the moderate cases in the Middle East, and the really easy cases in Europe.
Right. Well, I mean, the doing less with less makes a, you know, obviously makes a great deal of sense to me. And now before you suggested that you, in the end, are kind of you're more or less, you know, reducing the 8 carrier battle groups notwithstanding, you're more or less a navalist. And of course, you know, I'm more or less, I mean, once you watch the video, there's like a picture of an aircraft carrier right behind me, and there's a picture of, let me put it up like that, there's a picture of a naval battle right behind me too, so obviously I'm a navalist. You know, when navalists are going to watch this, they're going to say first that 8 carrier battle groups obviously isn't 8 carrier battle groups, right? It's 3 deployable aircraft carriers at any given time, which is not as 100% accurate. You know, obviously in periods of surging, you could do a little bit better than that, right? But in regular conditions, you're talking about 3 carrier battle groups. I think what they're also going to say with respect to Asia, and this is an argument that I agree with, that forward presence isn't just about getting in China's face, right? Forward presence is about building and maintaining a set of relationships between all of America's allies and all of America's adversaries that prevent day-to-day misunderstandings, that extend norms of low politics, friendly behavior. And this is something that's as straightforward as when an American destroyer and a Chinese destroyer conduct a courtesy visit with one another somewhere, and they do the same thing with the Japanese destroyer, that the forward presence creates a set of positive relationships, that it lays the foundation for cooperation against terrorists, against non-state actors like pirates. It lays the foundation for cooperation in issues of tremendous importance to East Asia, which includes disaster relief, right, where we've had, I mean, really, in the past 10 years, we've had 2 of the most horrific maritime disasters in history happen in East Asia, and the U.S. forward-deployed naval units played an important role in both of them in terms of saving lots of people's lives, right? And so people are going to argue, and I'm going to argue, that this is one of the things that's an upside for a forward presence. You know, I'm putting together a fairly shortish article on the Battle of Java Sea, which you don't really have to be all that familiar with. But I think it's a battle that a lot of people, and this was a battle in February 1942 against the Japanese Navy, it's a battle that a lot of people point to when they look at the real problems of not having a forward presence. And it's a battle where Americans and Dutch and Australians and British tried to cooperate against the Japanese, had a larger force, and were utterly unable to cooperate because they didn't speak the same language, they didn't have the right communications, they didn't have the right ordnance. And people point to battles like that and say, you know, this is what happens when you don't have a forward presence. You lose out on all of this relationship building. You lose out on all of this preparation, all of this stuff that you have to do in not only in hot wars against, you know, enemy A, but also in a whole set of lower politics things that you would like to do, like hunting pirates, like doing disaster relief, and that these are things that navies should be doing, and these are things the United States should be supporting. And this is, I mean, this is something I actually do sign on to, right? And I think it's actually, you know, almost a little unfortunate that forward presence also can have the effect of making China more paranoid, but then again, you know, building relationships, especially low politics relationships, with Chinese naval officers may be a way of making China less paranoid.
Yeah. So I just don't think that the threats to the United States posed by piracy or terrorism in Southeast Asia are of a scale that would warrant the sort of commitment that the United States has made to Asia. So again, I don't think the Chinese are really paranoid. I think that, you know, naval officials in particular will tell you that what the Navy, about, you know, the Navy's a global force for good. We save children when hurricanes and tsunamis and things come. I don't think the Chinese buy that story, and I don't really buy that story. I agree that it could be sort of an attendant consequence of something that we're doing for other reasons. But just to clarify, I'm not opposed to making port calls in Asia or doing things like that. I just think that if you look at, and in a sense, I sort of look back at the early Rumsfeld model, the sort of what in Central Asia was touted as a sort of lily pad model that goes back to transformation and all of those things. I think it's terrifically useful to have facilities that the United States could surge into in the event of a military problem that we saw as affecting us in an important enough way that we wanted to get in on the action. But I think you have to add to the ledger of this presence mission on, I think, the debit side is that, or if you agree with Brooks, Eikenberry, and Woolforth on the credit side, is that it tends to depress the autonomous and in some cases bilateral and multilateral exertions of Asian states that are really, you know, you can call them allies, but in many cases are security clients, right? When it comes down to it, they're reliant on the United States. So there's been this whole discussion, rumblings out of the new Japanese administration that there's going to be a defense review, that Japan is going to radically remilitarize by increasing its military spending by 2% after 10 years of consecutive cuts to military spending. And I look at that scenario and I say, look, the presence mission has everything to do with this. If we started from a standing start today, January 14th, 2013, and said, does Japan's security posture look like it's depending on the United States, or does it not look like it's depending on the United States? And if the United States had a little fuzzier commitment to Japan, would Japan look more like a grown-up country, like a similar country that it is today, or look less like a grown-up country? I think it does much more. So I agree that, you know, I'm as opposed to piracy and natural disasters as anyone is. But the idea that deploying 60% of the U.S. Navy to Asia to do that seems to me, A, inefficient, and B, utterly implausible to China. I wouldn't characterize it as paranoia. I would characterize it as having, you know, a pretty reasonable BS detector, to put it mildly. I just don't think they buy this story, and I don't think they should.
Right. Well,
I mean, Rob, reverse the sort of story. If they were sending, you know, 60% of their Navy into the Caribbean to deal with a much more serious drug trafficking problem.
Listen, no. You know, absolutely. What the Russians sent a cruiser to visit Venezuela, and it was seen with panic in U.S. naval circles, right? I definitely understand. At the same time, right, the United States does not appear to be, you know, currently we do devote these kinds of resources to places like the Mediterranean, the North Atlantic, in places that we clearly aren't interested in facing down a peer competitor, right? And so, you know, that's one way that the Chinese could look at it. It's like, well, the Americans do this everywhere, even when they don't have an interest in doing it. In which case, something like the Asian pivot or something like retrenchment out of Europe and out of the Middle East, you know, could theoretically even be more alarming to the Chinese, because then they could say, well, they don't do this anywhere else except around us. What is it about us?
No, I think that's quite right.
Right. Anyway, I mean, we're sort of at the end of our time here, but we should definitely do this again. We should have another conversation about these issues. I think it's been productive.
It was a pleasure, Rob, and thanks again for overlooking my previous screw-up.
Well, everybody makes mistakes. We lost a fabulous one 2 weeks ago on Santa Claus. It was all my fault. So.
Well, that comes around.
We'll have to wait a whole nother year for that to do one on Santa Claus. So, all right. Well, thank you, Foreign Entanglements viewers, and please come back next week.
Thanks again.